Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am John Milford, chair of the club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Gordon Lithgow. Dr. Lithgow received his Ph.D. in genetics from the University of Glasgow, Scotland. He completed postdoctoral training at the Institute for Behavioral Genetics at the University of Colorado Boulder. Dr. Lithgow was a senior lecturer in molecular gerontology at the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Manchester in England before coming to the Buck Institute in 2001. He is principal investigator and director of the Buck Institute's Interdisciplinary Research Consortium on Geroscience. He's also the principal investigator of the Larry L. Hillblom Network on the Chemical Biology of Aging and is the coordinator of the Hillblom Center for the Biology of Aging Support Award. And now let's welcome Dr. Gordon Lithgow.
Thank you. I'd like to start by, as all, using our imaginations. Picture this. It's the year 2063, and you're all 26 years old. And you're at medical school, and you're lying on a beach, and you're taking part in a lecture. In some sort of virtual, real-time, interactive fashion, you're listening to a lecture on trauma medicine. And the old professor is going on and taking a tangent again. And it's a tangent that you've heard before, because she likes to tell you, not about trauma medicine, but about the various diseases that she had to deal with when she was a junior intern. And in fact, some of the diseases that she was involved in finding cures. And they sound terrible, or awful, with terrible presentations and awful prognosis. Names like Alzheimer's, sarcopenia, Parkinson's disease, and so on. And you're kind of bored by this. You're bored because you've heard it before, and you're also bored because you're not going to have to diagnose anyone with Alzheimer's. You're not going to have to treat anyone with Parkinson's disease. You're not going to have to treat frailty in the same way as we do today. Quite frankly, all of those diseases, the chronic diseases of late life, are all in the trash can of biomedical science. Picture this. It's 2063. You're all 26. You would like to go to medical school, but you can't because your family needs you to be bringing in dollars rather than taking out loans. And your family needs you to do that because the family is looking after three elderly grandparents with infirmities, one diagnosed with Alzheimer's, one with a cancer, one with Parkinson's disease. And they live in long-term care facilities, and the family is struggling to pay for the care. And you're a bit worried about one of your parents as well who's showing early signs of Parkinson's. So instead of lying on the beach in medical school, you're making your way to a long-term care facility where people are suffering terrifying and painful diseases. And where we are today, most people would say, I think, people who think about these issues, that we're on our way, we're down the tracks towards the second picture. These are two radically different fictitious pictures of the future, of course. But we're kind of heading towards the second picture. The demographers and the economists who look at these issues suggest to us that the way that the population is changing, the fact that we are becoming older as a population, the fraction of elderly in the population, is a wonderful thing because it's based on great success in the past, but now presents this problem of human chronic age-related disease. So the reason I'm going to talk to you tonight about the topic, and the topic is one that affects us all, but also I think is increasingly affecting the economic and social health of this country and essentially every country in the world. The topic is the process of aging and why aging is related to disease and what we're going to do about it. And whilst economists and demographers and others will suggest to us that we're going down this road towards a tremendous challenge for our society, there are some scientists, a few, and these are, you know, hard-nosed, conservative, you know, scientists who would like to see data, that are beginning to suggest or have come to the conclusion that we actually don't need to go down that road at all. That actually we have a choice between those two visions of the future. A choice between those two. And it's based on observations made in a number of labs throughout the world, basically on simple animals in a simple basic biology of aging. And I'm going to talk about the last 20 years of those studies, what's happened over the last 20 years, and what it means for us now, and whether we really do have a choice or not. So we start with an observation that everyone is aware of, and that is that if you look at developed countries, if you look at populations like ourselves, aging is the largest risk factor for chronic disease. As you get older, the likelihood of diseases like Alzheimer's and cancers and so on increase exponentially. Now, it's odd that, because it's such an obvious thing and the data is so clear, it's strange that we don't actually think about aging very often when we're thinking about how to prevent these diseases. Most people studying Alzheimer's disease, for example, don't think about aging at all. In fact, many of those people are trying to recreate Alzheimer's in young laboratory animals so they can study the disease faster. They're taking aging out of the picture altogether. So I think this is really important, and it's something that will be a thread all the way through, that aging is our largest risk factor. And many studies, of some of which I'll talk about in the last 20 years, have gone further than this association between aging and disease and started to say, you know what, it looks like the deep fundamental mechanisms that cause us to age are very similar to the fundamental mechanisms early in the course of disease. It's kind of like we're studying the same thing. And many of us have got to the point where we're saying aging, not just as a risk factor, but it causes disease. It's a cause. Second thing that's come out of these laboratory experiments is that it's fairly trivial to slow aging. We kind of do it every day up at the Buck Institute in microscopic worms, in flies. People are working in mice now. And slowing aging is entirely possible in these simple animals. Now, you take those two points. You say aging causes chronic human disease, all the big ones we're talking about, and scientists in lab are at will changing aging rates. You think, well, maybe there's an opportunity here to bring those two things together. That's really what I'm talking about. So you, like me, are probably quite skeptical of the idea that aging can cause a plethora of different human diseases. If you imagine, for example, cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, cancer, diabetes, sarcopenia, these are all very different kinds of conditions. They present in different ways. They're treated in different ways. And the prognosis for each is quite different as well. And what on earth can we have in common between, say, a cancer of the pancreas and Alzheimer's disease? Well, maybe nothing, but we should consider some other diseases. How about polio, German measles, smallpox, mumps, tuberculosis, diphtheria, and so on? These diseases all present in different ways as well. They affect different tissues, and they have different prognoses. But in the end, we know that they are actually caused by a single thing. Microbes, microorganisms. And when we understood that in the last century, all these very different diseases could be looked at through a single lens, and that is, how do you stop the microbes from doing this? And then you've got a whole bunch of people like Jenner and others who developed therapeutic approaches. Two approaches. One, you prevent it. You prevent it through vaccines. Two, you stop it from happening. You stop it from happening through antibiotics. And those two single therapeutic approaches, all aimed at reducing the impact of microbes on our bodies, essentially put all of these diseases into history, for the most part, in developed countries. You know, I'm old enough to remember hospitals and churches collecting money to build iron lungs to treat children with polio. I'm old enough to remember all the signposts dotted around Scotland. All the signposts pointed to the sanatoriums that had been built out in the countryside so that people would get fresh air. And the investment in iron machines and investment in sanatoriums didn't cure those diseases. Those efforts were curing symptoms, or dealing with symptoms, I should say. the antibiotics and the vaccines, those were the real things. Investment in a science that meaningfully attacked the root cause, not just the symptoms. Okay, let's go back to the other diseases, the chronic diseases of late life. Is it possible that aging is a single cause of these diseases? Just in the same way that microbes cause the whole constellation of diseases, the aging process itself is at the root cause of many chronic diseases. I think that that's really the big question, and the choice, part of the choice that we have to make is whether we want to investigate that hypothesis. It's an idea, and it's a very powerful idea, because we already know ways to change and manipulate the rates of aging in model organisms in the laboratory. And so if that idea holds water, there's the hope that we could develop therapies not just for one age-related disease, but for many. And that's really important, because if we found a cure for cancers, all human cancers, it would be important, of course. But on average, it would only extend lifespan by about, what do you think, 3 years. On average, lifespan would only be extended 3 years by cures of all cancers. And that's because these diseases of chronic diseases of aging are all coming in waves one after the other. And the notion that if you can simply control the aging process in some way to prevent one, chances are you'll prevent 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's the idea. Where did this idea come from? It starts with genes, actually. And I should talk about genes and aging for a little bit. People ask me, what's the best way to live long? And I always tell them that if you want to live long, get yourself some long-lived parents. And the reason for that is that if you think about human longevity variation, you know, the longest lived, the shortest lived, you've got quite a variation there, a huge variation, in fact. And if you look at twin studies and you try and take into account the environment, you can come to the conclusion that about 40% of the variation in human longevity is driven by genes. So you get handed a set of cards when you're born that determine in large part how long you're going to live. And that's disappointing. But the good news is the 60% of the variation in human longevity is governed by environmental factors. And that's things like what we eat. That's things like our early life exposures. That's things like our behavioral, what we smoke, what we drink. I didn't say it was easy to control these, but it's possible that this 60% is under some of our control. And it would be nice to really get into that and work out what best to do in order to bring that home. I mean, most accounts are that there's something like 10 years of longevity sitting on the table. 10 years for everyone to either pick up or let go, depending on how we live. I think that's good news. Now, that's humans. But as a biologist, I've known for a long time that genes and aging went together, because I've known for a long time that different species live different lengths of time. And these animals, things like roundworms and fruit flies that live a matter of days, are actually still made of the same stuff of animals that live a long time, like ourselves in our 80s, bowhead whales, 180 years, and the record holders, the clams, 220 years. They're all made of the same stuff. They're all made of fat and protein and carbohydrate and nucleic acids, just like us. But the difference in lifespan is extraordinary between the shortest-lived animals and the longest-lived. Now, they're not made of different stuff, so what's making the difference? Genes. It's genes that are building these bodies, and they're building them in different ways, and as a result, they live a tremendously different length of time. Actually, you should be aware the world record holder right now for longevity is a quailog clam. The record is 507 years, and you determine this by counting the little wrinkles on the shell. And clams have hearts, beating hearts. And it's really fascinating to think there are hearts beating now on planet Earth that have been beating for over 500 years. Now, wouldn't cardiovascular surgeons like to know what's going on there? And people are actually looking at this issue as to how they're able to achieve this. I think it's fun to think about people who are alive at the same time as some of the clams in our oceans at the moment. I, of course, being Scottish, think of Mary, Queen of Scots. Truly extraordinary longevity of an animal. So They live all different lengths of time. They're all made of the same stuff. This is genes. But what genes? How do we find these genes? Well, this story starts with the choice of an organism, an animal, for laboratory work by Sidney Brenner. Sidney Brenner was a famous biologist at Medical Research Council in Cambridge in England. And he'd been involved in all these amazing discoveries in molecular biology, classical molecular biology. And he wanted to study the development of the nervous system, the development of the brain. And he found a tiny little animal, and he eventually shared a Nobel Prize for making this choice. He found a tiny animal called Cynorhabditis elegans, and that's the animal that myself and my colleagues at the Buck Institute work on. It's microscopic. I could have brought some here tonight, but you can't see them anyway, so just imagine. It's transparent. It has about 1,000 cells, and it has an amazing life. It develops in 3 days from eggs to adults. It senses its environment. There are sexual behaviors. It reproduces. It lays about 310 offspring in about 4 or 5 days, a massive increase in the population. And then it starts to slow down. And you can see, because it's transparent, the tissues are beginning to change. The intestine becomes darker. These large holes appear. The muscles start to degenerate, very much like in human sarcopenia. And they tend to slow down in their eating. Eventually, they become non-responsive. Their learning and memory goes really badly down. And they're doing all this with 300 neurons, by the way. This is not a large-brained animal, but they have all these complexities. And after about 20 days, they die. And it's this very short lifespan that's made this animal the darling of people who want to study the biology of aging. And many thousands of people get up every morning and go into laboratories and take these animals out of incubators and sit at microscopes and look at their aging every day, because we are learning so much from this animal. The reason we're using this animal is not just Sidney's choice of it as a great model organism to study neurobiology, but also two people, Mike Klass and Tom Johnson at the University of Colorado. And Mike and Tom were working on various things, but Tom did this amazing experiment where he bred different strains of these tiny worms together. And then he looked at the offspring, and he measured their lifespan. And it was different. And that lifespan was then genetically passed down through a generation. And so he said, what I've done here is I've crossed two lines, I've got new assortments of genes, and those genes are driving different lifespans. So he essentially proved that longevity had a genetic basis, even within a species. But he went on, because Mike and Tom had a bet. Because Mike thought there was very few genes involved, and Tom thought, no, there's going to be thousands and thousands of genes. It's a myriad of complexity. We'll never identify any. And so Mike went ahead and looked for mutants, genetic mutants. And so these are animals where he used a chemical mutagen, and he found 2, 3, 4 lines of these simple roundworms that were long-lived. And he concluded that, wow, maybe there are only a few genes that are involved in making them long-lived. And actually, he left aging research, and Tom continued with it. So he lost the bet, but he thought, this is fantastic. And he did a lot of complex genetics over the next 5 or 6 years, and he proved in the end that all of these worms were longer lived because of a single gene, which he called AGE1. He didn't know what that gene was, but it was the first time anyone had published a genetic mutation in a single gene that altered the lifespan of an organism. Let me show you what he did. He essentially was coming into the lab. He would have 100 animals all born on the same day, and he would follow them down the microscope, and each day he would poke them with a wire to see if they were alive or dead. And eventually some would die early at 15 days. There would be a great wave of death through the population, and some would live as long as 33 days. But the average was something like, 23 days. But the long-lived mutants that he had shown there was a mutation in a single gene, they didn't do that. They started dying around about the same time, but their mean lifespan was something like 37 days, and their maximum was way out past 55 days. So something like a 70% increase in lifespan, mean and maximum lifespan. Now, okay, this is a worm, and we're talking about days, but if you were to extrapolate that to humans, that, again, is extraordinary. It's an extraordinary difference, the idea that you can make an animal live 70% longer. So Tom published, and actually it wasn't very well received by some people who thought that there must be thousands of genes. It has to be complex. You can't have single gene mutations just extending lifespan. But Tom was right. And many other people came into the field, notably Cynthia Kenyon from UCSF. And they showed that there were other genes that determined lifespan. And they showed what those genes were, and they showed the relationships of these genes. And basically, it all took off. Lots of young, bright scientists wanted to get into worm aging. And they did in droves. And they found their own genes. And they found their own aging pathways. And they've published hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of papers over the last 20 years. What have we learned? Well, first of all, it's surprisingly easy to modulate aging. Naturally, there are lots of genes that do this. We're back up to about 550 genes that when you mutate them or alter them in some way, you see these massive extensions in lifespan. The effect size is really surprising. Surprisingly, and this was not at all expected, it's the same kind of genes in different species. So there's actually evidence now that some of those first genes identified by Cynthia Kenyon are the same kind of genes that determine longevity in ourselves. It's variants of those genes that account for some of the variation in human longevity. And that created a lot of hope, a hope that's still around now, is that we can use these simple animals like worms and flies and yeast and so on to tell us something fundamental about our own aging processes. And so this effort is continuing. There was no single cause to aging. I guess some people thought there would be a clock. You know, there'd be some single thing that would tick away and it would monitor your biological time, and when it was time to go, it actively killed you. That doesn't seem to be the case. There are many, many genes, many hundreds of genes, doing all sorts of different things in the body. And importantly, a lot of those genes are doing things in young bodies. This isn't about actively aging. In fact, it's about actively doing other things that happen to have an effect on aging later on. And we can talk about that in questions if you're interested. But it is complex, and we don't want to shy away from that. These hundreds of genes are all interacting with each other in ways that we're still trying to understand. Another thing we've learned, and this is really my attempt at giving you a general feeling, a general overarching theme for what's happened. And it really ends up in a conclusion that aging is a loss of homeostasis. So I know that many of you will be aware of sort of clinical homeostasis and what that means, but I want to give you just a quick description of biological homeostasis. So if you think about an animal, you know, a field mouse, it can only live under certain conditions. It has to have sufficient food. The temperature has to be right. It has to get the right amount of water. It has to not be exposed to environmental toxins. In other words, there's this multidimensional space that it can live in. All the different components of the environment that could affect its lifespan and its reproduction. And if you're in the good part, you're in the tolerance zone. You're able to reproduce in that niche, if you like. And the niche, being in the middle of the tolerance zone, means you're optimal. Your physiology is optimal for reproduction and health. But what happens when the environment changes? Something we're all thinking about. When the environment changes, you're no longer, your physiology isn't in the optimal spot anymore. You've moved off. And what homeostatic mechanisms do is try to drag your body, try to drag your physiology to a new place where it will be optimal for that new environment, those new conditions. And these are all sorts of things. These are hormonal pathways involved in stress response. These are physiological metabolic changes, gene expression changes, which genes are turned off and on. Stuff is happening at every single level to try and get you back to the optimal. So a lot of biology is called homeostatic mechanisms. We think, though, that during aging, the homeostatic mechanisms become degraded in some way. Old animals are less able to adjust to change, and they are frequently sensitive to stress, and they are defective at the very fundamental cellular and molecular levels in the mechanisms that you need to go back to the optimal state. And we think what these aging genes, these aging mutations that we've all been studying, a lot of them, what they seem to do is they seem to regain that ability to respond to environmental change. And so they take the animal back to the optimal part of the tolerance zone. So what they do, the mutations, I should say, what the mutations do is they enhance homeostasis. They essentially allow animals to keep it together for longer. And if you look in detail at the kind of things these genes are controlling, it's these pathways that respond to environmental stress. Things like insulin signaling pathways, repair and metabolic control pathways, endocrine pathways. So all of this then has an impact on aging and aging outcomes. So as I say, it's complicated, but we are beginning to understand how these bits fit together. And this general idea that it's really the animal's ability to respond to change that's been degraded during aging lets us think about how we could reverse that process. So let's go back to aging at the center of a constellation of diseases. If aging is a failure of homeostasis and we can reverse or repair an animal's ability to withstand change, then perhaps we can have an impact on all these disease states. This throws up an interesting notion, probably something you've maybe been thinking about from the start, and that is if we understand aging mechanisms and we know what the genes are, well, why wouldn't we come up with therapies that target those aging mechanisms? That's really what we're talking about. We're talking about interventions. Now, it could be drugs, but it could be dietary. It could be all sorts of different ways in which we could intervene, including exercise and some of the things we think about. But let's just go with drugs or chemical compounds at the moment. Can we find chemical compounds that slow aging? Absolutely we can. And we're doing it all the time in laboratories. A landmark study published in 2010 showed a drug in clinical use in transplantation medicine called rapamycin extended the lifespan of mice, laboratory mice. And this was an NIH-funded study conducted at three centers, so everybody got it right. It was a very, very well-done study published in Nature. And we think we know why rapamycin extends lifespan in mice, because it targets a pathway that was previously identified through genetics as being involved in aging. It was found on the island of Rapa Nui, by the way, which my wife, Julie Anderson, who studies Parkinson's disease, is there right now tonight. They're having a conference on Parkinson's, and she's very interested because they've completed a study with rapamycin and they see beneficial effects in Parkinson's mouse models. So this is a very, very interesting candidate, and lots of labs are working on this. It's quite interesting. The biology of aging people were looking at this, and the results were published, and then you lift up your head and you see what other people have been doing with rapamycin. And it's extraordinary because it's in all sorts of clinical trials for all sorts of chronic diseases, including cancers. And so it actually fits the bill very nicely for a compound that maybe is targeting aging and then having this effect on a constellation of disease states. So we've found scores and scores and scores of compounds that extend lifespan. Actually, one of the first papers out at the Buck Institute we published back in 2000 was one of the first examples of a compound that had this effect in worms, extended worm lifespan. So you're probably thinking that I must be an incredibly wealthy chap and that I spend all my time chasing away the pharmaceutical companies from my office door because they're desperate to develop these compounds into drugs. And neither of those two things are true. Remotely true. And the reason for that is something called the Valley of Death. And this could essentially be another talk, but I wanted to mention it because it's important to think about. The Valley of Death is the valley between basic researchers conducting experiments in labs and publishing them in high-profile journals and being reported in the New York Times and all sorts of places. The valley is between them and the doctor and the patient. And the valley is traditionally crossed by the pharmaceutical industry. And you can build a bridge. It costs about $1.5 billion to build a bridge between basic research and the delivery of a drug. And these two numbers, I've got two numbers to tell you about here. One is 800,000 and one is 21. The 800,000 refers to the number of biomedical research papers published in the year 2008 with a view to, wow, this could be a way to develop a therapy for this disease. 21 was the number of applications to the FDA for approval of drugs in the same year. In other words, there's a lot of science has not been translated, and it's money. It's money. And no matter how we look at this, whether you're a fan of the pharmaceutical industry or not, it doesn't matter. It's about how do we build a bridge from the basic research to druggable targets and to drugs that effectively can treat chronic disease. So the science is beginning to get there, and I'm going to tell you a bit more of the science that's encouraging, but remember the Valley of Death. Remember that this is a critical place where we need investment. I mean, $1.5 billion is a big number, but it's a small number compared to the costs of the diseases that the development of effective therapies against Alzheimer's cost us today and in the future. It's a very small number compared to the cash holdings of some tech companies in the Bay Area. It's a small number compared to bank profits in the East Coast, but I guess that is a different talk. I'm just going to talk about some more promising drug candidates, and this is mainly work from my own lab, just to let you know the kind of things that we're doing at the Buck Institute, and I hope you'll all come up and see it firsthand. And to explain one class of compounds, I want to talk a little bit about protein homeostasis. So I've mentioned homeostasis, and protein homeostasis is really a molecular version of that. It so happens that all proteins have a three-dimensional shape, and that shape informs biochemists about their function. And during aging, what happens to many of those proteins is that they lose their shape. And when they lose their shape, they lose their function. And this has been of interest to me and some other researchers for a number of years now, that the notion that proteins are becoming damaged, and when they do this, when they lose their shape, they become sticky and they stick together, form clumps. So protein homeostasis are all the molecular mechanisms in your body that try and prevent this from happening. And I'll just give you one example. One example are the molecular chaperones. And the molecular chaperones are a class of proteins in our bodies, in our cells, that bind to this stuff. They bind to damaged proteins. And they bind and release, and they bind and release. And gently, over time, in an energy-dependent process, they allow the protein to refold in its correct shape. And when it does that, it regains its function. And the other thing they do is they get rid of the stuff as well. They target it for degradation. So we were playing with molecular chaperones, and we showed that if you engineered a worm to make more molecular chaperones, make more of this stuff, they would live longer. So we had a hunch that protein homeostasis was important. And so I started going to conferences where protein chemists hang out. Went to stress conferences because they were very interested in protein homeostasis as well. Oh, I meant to say another illustration. That what happens when you crack an egg into a hot frying pan, the clear protein denatures, just as I've been describing, and goes white. That biochemical level is very much what we think is going on in our cells as we age. Greatly accelerated in the frying pan, of course. So I would go to these conferences where people who studied this process of protein misfolding were talking, and there was another group of people there, and these people weren't protein chemists as such. They were studying Alzheimer's disease. And because they were making discoveries that the brains of Alzheimer's cases accumulated damaged proteins, specifically in these things that you'll know of as plaques, amyloid plaques. And the amyloid plaques contained a lot of material of misfolded proteins, sticky proteins that would fall out of solution and aggregate. And it was thought that some of the precursors to this stuff, this aggregated protein, was neurotoxic. And today that's the picture that we've generally got today, is that the precursors to the big insoluble aggregates are neurotoxic. So there they were trying to understand this at these stress conferences, where these protein chemists were hanging out. And I thought that was fascinating, that I had come at it from simple biology of aging in worms. They'd come at it through looking at pathology of aging brains, and we both ended up at the same conferences talking to protein chemists about protein homeostasis. So going back to the lab, we say, well, can we really show this? Can we show that maintaining protein quality determines normal lifespan in these simple worms? Can we get at mechanism? And a postdoctoral researcher working in my lab, who's actually about to return to Mexico this week to set up the first worm aging lab in Mexico, Silvestre Alves, had a great idea. He said, well, I know a thing or two about amyloids because I was a neurochemist, and I know there's a whole bunch of dyes that we use to stain amyloid in human brains or in human tissues where these nasty proteins are accumulating. And he said, I'm going to put those on worms. He squirted them on worms and nothing happened. And he went back a year later and he squirted them on again at higher concentrations. And this time he began to see some very interesting things. An example of one of these dyes is curcumin, by the way, found in the Indian spice turmeric. And turmeric is being suggested by some people to explain the rather low rates of Alzheimer's in India. So we looked at curcumin, and we would take this powder and make a solution and squirt it onto agar plates containing our worms, and then we would just see what happened. One of the things that happened was we looked at a strain of worms that were engineered to get Alzheimer's. This was done by a good friend of ours, Chris Link, at the University of Colorado. Chris took worms, and he engineered them to make a human protein associated with this amyloid material. So essentially, the worms now formed amyloid plaques. Now, they don't get Alzheimer's in the classical sense, of course, but they do have this pathology and they do get very sick as a result of this process. And so when Silvestri grew the worms on the thioflavin T, he noted that the worm amyloid plaques were not forming. They do form eventually, but they formed much, much later. So these compounds were having an effect on protein homeostasis. They were keeping these proteins soluble and in the correct shape. And so the next question for us was, well, okay, now that begs the question, does it also affect aging? We've shown that protein homeostasis is affected. We predict it's going to extend lifespan, and it did, anywhere from 30 to 70%. So this is a very nice story, and it attracted quite a lot of attention, including the New York Times, because some of these compounds had already found their way into humans. And a compound called thioflavin T, we showed extended lifespan. Well, a modified form of thioflavin T is used to image Alzheimer's plaques in brains clinically today. It's used in PET scans. And so all sorts of interesting questions arose about whether these compounds or compounds like these could ever be effective in slowing down the pathology of Alzheimer's in people. And I don't know the answer. We're moving these compounds into mice right now. We're looking at neurological disease, and we're looking at aging as well. And our expectation is that maybe not this, but something like this will be effective in those conditions. And, you know, I've shown this to a number of chemists and to people in industry, and many of them said, well, yeah, this isn't going to work for a drug, you know, because this is a dirty drug. This is going to affect lots of processes. And, you know, I think that's why it works. We are seeing time and time again the kind of compounds that slow aging and prevent protein aggregation and prevent other aging pathologies are the kind of things that the pharmaceutical companies would generally shy away from. Many of them are natural products, but many of them just are dirty drugs, likely to have multiple targets. So, again, we could talk about that in question time later, but we'll see how this story develops. Second to last example, lithium. Now, lithium, as you know, is used to treat bipolar disorder. And it's been touted by some to also increase health. I don't know if you're aware of the Oregon's Lithia Park. I wasn't until we started working on this. This is up in Ashland in Oregon. Lithia Park was established because of the potential health benefits of lithium. They have very high levels of lithium in the drinking water. And they built fountains. They've got a beautiful set of fountains for people to go up and collect the lithium-enriched water, spring water, it's a mineral water. And the locals swear that this is very effective in keeping them happy. And it may be doing more than keeping them happy, to be honest, because we've seen that lithium has the same effects as the drug I just showed you. It slows down protein aggregation, promotes protein homeostasis, and extends lifespan. And we actually found the lifespan thing, it was serendipitous a number of years ago and published, but the protein aggregation thing we've been starting to look at again now. This is unpublished, and it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing at preventing the age-related accumulation of damaged proteins. So we're very interested in it. My wife Julie's interested in it because she's shown that it's efficacious in mouse models of Parkinson's disease. So you can see a pattern here. Every time we find one of these things that affect aging, it also seems to be effective in some sort of age-related condition. And lithium is also, the other reason I'm mentioning lithium is it's FDA approved. It's FDA approved. That means the valley of death has already been crossed for lithium. Lithium could be used in people today. Now, it's a dirty drug, physicians don't like it, and it has side effects. Julie's work suggests that it could be efficacious in Parkinson's at concentrations much, much lower than those used for bipolar disorder. So right now, there's a need to perform clinical trials on lithium in the Parkinson's space. We'll see if that happens. Hopefully it will. The problem with FDA-approved drugs generally is there isn't much money to be made anymore. Let me close with this one. And this is really an advert for a talk that I'll give with my younger researcher who made a fantastic discovery recently on the sunshine vitamin, vitamin D. We actually have an expert on vitamin D sitting in the front row here, Dr. William Grant. And just one of these things, I was not aware of what was going on with this thing until it came out of a screen in our own lab. We were looking for compounds that stopped the amyloid worms, the A-beta aggregating in the worms. And this compound is gangbusters at doing that. And it was only then we started to read about the amazing things that are going on with vitamin D, the great debate about what the vitamin D levels should be, the fact that probably it's at too low levels in the elderly population, and critically, it is tied, at least epidemiologically, to a myriad, hundreds of human diseases, of which many of the chronic diseases we're talking about are there too. So it really fits as a potential candidate. It's really a hormone rather than a vitamin. It's a potential candidate for something that's readily available, cheap. And I think if we understood what the mechanism is, we're finding, okay, I'll let you know now, it slows aging. It slows aging dramatically. And we're very excited about which form of vitamin D is doing this and what the mechanism might be. And we're excited because everyone else is excited about vitamin D in human populations. So let me just close by saying I really do believe that promotion of homeostasis is one way that we can think about attacking age-related disease across a wide board, across a wide sweep. And that I've become one of the believers, I was certainly a skeptic earlier on, but I've become one of the believers that targeting aging mechanisms themselves is a new way to think about combating the biggest challenge of the 21st century in terms of biomedicine, and socially and economically. With that, I'll stop. Thank you. Welcome your questions.
Thank you, Dr. Lifshaw. We'd like to remind our listening audience, this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. You're listening to Dr. Gordon Lithgow, and his talk is The Connection of Aging and Prevention of Chronic Disease. I know there are many questions here, so I'd like to pass the mic, if you'll take questions.
Absolutely.
Doctor. All right. Candice, if you'd pass the mic to...
First of all, thanks for a very interesting presentation. A lot of people talk about, as you get older, about poor quality of life, and they don't want to extend their life. To what extent do you have confidence that these methods to increase people's lifespans would affect positively the whole range of things that would deteriorate life potentially?
Very, very important question, because there's absolutely no point in enhanced longevity without enhancing what we call health span as well. Not only putting off disease pathologies, but just general health. And I think the news is really good there, that most of these manipulations, including some of these compounds I've been talking about, extend health span as well. The worms wriggle around the plate for much longer than normal if they've been treated. A very important data set comes from mice that have been calorically restricted. So if you reduce the number of calories available to a mouse, under the amount it would eat if it was free will, if you take that down about 40%, lifespan increases about 40% as well in the laboratory. And that's a really great example where you can see many pathologies of aging, many cancers are eradicated, and other pathologies are pushed way, way back. So you get a healthier animal for much, much longer, and then a very steep decline at the end. That obviously would be the ideal scenario for the human population as well.
Yes, I apologize for getting here a little bit late. My question is about sleep, the quality of sleep if you are a senior citizen, things you can do to make sure you have good sleep or mitigate the lack of it, and the impact it has on your brain if you're not getting enough sleep.
Yes, again, great question. There's absolutely no doubt the quality of sleep is a major factor in aging trajectory. We've kind of known this from people, but we're beginning to also see it in these model organisms as well. So there's an effort to actually understand the relationship of some of the aging genes with some of the true clock genes that modify our circadian rhythms. Clearly, with age, a circadian rhythm becomes degraded, and it can have health impacts. And there's also a large debate about just the effects of our common modern lifestyle, and it appears like we're getting less and less sleep, and what that could have even for young people in the longer term. So I'm no expert, but I'm listening to people, and it's apparently a very, very important thing.
So I heard a lecture by Aubrey de Grey on how he broke up the way in which aging can be broken down into assessments, for instance, the degradation of the cell, then the intercellular material, et cetera. How it seemed very rational. How common in terms of organizing your research and research within this industry are they staying within those silos to sort of drill down? Because you've described sort of the, you know, taking vitamin D, for instance, has this effect, but there's a long, big gap between, you know, what actually is occurring mechanically or
yes.
chemically between those two points. Can you describe, like, where, what's how mature is the research to stay organized in those silos?
I think this is a young science. I really do. I think that we are just opening the door. We're getting some idea. And, of course, every scientist, and Aubrey's a good friend, every scientist thinks the experiments that they're doing are the ones that are most important. Otherwise, they wouldn't do them. They'd be doing something else. And so you do have a range of activities. You do have people who are interested in protein homeostasis and other people who are interested in telomeres. It's all very important. I think, though, what's happening, and the reason that we set up an interdisciplinary center on geroscience at the Buck Institute, is that it's really going to take people from very different disciplines to crack this problem. So it's not just the cell biologists and looking at the macromolecular damage and turnover. It's going to be the cancer biologists. It's going to be the neuroscientists. It's going to be the bioinformatics people. Really, people are beginning to come together. You can see it at conferences. You know, 15 years ago, the people working on telomeres, the ends of your chromosomes, had nothing to say to the people working on worms. And that's all changed. That has all changed completely. We're all in each other's back pockets. We're all listening to each other. We're all swapping stories. And I think that we're beginning to see the emergence of a central paradigm in homeostasis, how I describe it. Other people would use different words. But I think we're all moving out of the silos and moving down the road together.
And I apologize for being late as well, but how soon would you have to take some of the things that you're talking about in terms of retardants? So you mentioned vitamin D. Would I really have to start when I'm 20 or 10, or can I wait till I'm 80 to do that? So
we usually get that question of when can I stop drinking, doctor? I think that perhaps not surprisingly, at least in laboratory animals, the effects are larger if you start sooner. That's certainly true for the caloric restriction in mice. But actually, it's never too late. And so even in late-life animals, there are benefits to be had by moving them to a caloric restriction diet. I think that's true for some of the compounds, but it's very early days. We haven't even done many of those experiments. But I guess the other side of this is that essentially, much of what I'm talking about is preventing disease by getting in and altering an aging mechanism. What we don't know is whether these agents can also have some reversal effect. And one of my colleagues, Simon Melov at the Buck Institute, he's very interested in this. And he's actually shown reversal in a couple of different ways. But one way was very simple. Exercise. He was working with a muscle scientist from Canada, and they were looking at the genes that are turned on and off with an exercise intervention. And it didn't just slow the aging process in that case. It reversed it. Exercise reversed the what's called the gene expression profile to a youthful-looking profile. And I think we're all astounded by that. And we all signed up for the gym, of course. I think the idea of reversal is alive and well, very much so with Aubrey's ideas, is that there will be things where we're not just slowing down the accumulation of damage, but we're getting in and seeing some reversal. Because a lot of these pathways, you know, they're responding to stress and they have to fix some damage. Stress does cause damage, and there are agents there like molecular chaperones that actually do that. So there's some hope.
Sorry. In addition to exercise, without attempting to invade your privacy, is due to your researches or anything that you do yourself?
I used to take great pride in, if I was ever giving a public talk, stand up at the beginning of the talk and say, I want to tell you before we start that there is nothing that you can buy in a health food store, and there's nothing that your doctor can prescribe to you that's proven to slow your aging rate. And now I don't say that anymore. I don't know if it's just because I'm getting older, or more hopeful, or more desperate, but I because of the work with the amyloid-binding dyes, I started eating a lot more Indian meals and thinking about ways to deliver turmeric. And then our recent vitamin D work has just spent the whole labs in a tailspin about what their vitamin D levels should be. So I think it does. I mean, I think we, if you talk to the younger scientists, it really does affect the way that they lead their lives. And the effects of exercise are extraordinary. And I think if you see the Buck Institute, you see a very fit-looking group of people. And I think that they are convinced that it's important.
I have a question regarding vitamin D. We've heard different reports on vitamin D, and my husband and I were taking vitamin D pills,
D3,
which we were told on an aging at Commonwealth a few years ago.
Brain health.
It was a brain health. And then recently we were just told that basically the vitamin D in pill form may not be good for us, and basically it's from the sun and from foods naturally is the way we should be getting our vitamin D, that there can be different side effects, et cetera, if you're taking the pill form. And we came away from that session just saying, let's get rid of all vitamins and let's just eat our natural healthy foods, and maybe this is the best route to go. What is your feeling?
Well, I'm confused as well, and I'm certainly no expert. But I will say that, again, it points to the need for research. And I think maybe if we understood the deep molecular mechanisms by which vitamin D is acting, then we might be able to work our way back up again to these issues of doses and delivery. But I want to refer that question over to Dr. William Grant, who's an expert in the field.
Okay, vitamin D3 that you get from the pill form is the same as you get in fish like salmon or sardines, and the same as you make in your skin from the sun. Now, vitamin D2 is another fat, that's made from mushrooms or yeast. That's not as effective, and so that you don't want to take. The problem with a lot of these studies, the randomized controlled trial studies in vitamin D, is they think of it as a drug, and they forget that you have natural sources, and so they forget to measure the serum vitamin D levels before they enroll people in the studies and after they dose them for a while. And then for so many years, they use too little vitamin D to see an effect. Bruce Hollis and Carol Wagner in South Carolina found that pregnant women need 4,000 IU per day to raise their serum level to 40 nanograms, and help control gene expression during pregnancy. I've looked at all the observational studies, and if African Americans have 16 nanograms on average, white Americans have 26, and African Americans have a lot more health problems than white Americans do, and if you look at the dose response between 25-hydroxy vitamin D and cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, infectious diseases, you find that going from 16 to 25, you got about a 20 to 30% increase in reduction in disease risk, and you want to get to around 40 at least, to where you've got sort of the plateau. You're going to have a little bit of benefit going higher. There are no adverse effects going up to about 80 or so nanograms, although we don't have that much evidence. I mean, there's some studies that found an adverse effect at higher levels, but I think it's because the people enrolled in the studies started taking vitamin D just before the study. And so, for example, you find that for in frailty in men in the United States, there's a linear relationship, higher vitamin D, lower frailty. But for women, it's a U-shaped relationship, and I think that's because the women were told by their physicians, take vitamin D, but taking vitamin D at age 60 cannot reduce frailty overnight. So, anyway, it's a very exciting field right now, and the studies that come out that say that you don't need vitamin D for bones and so on, they're based. You've got to look at the larger body of evidence, and it's very, very supportive of very strong vitamin D effects.
Thank you.
Now, I have one quick question myself. How does your work relate to the mitochondrial theory of aging?
Yes, so the mitochondrial theory of aging is a really nice idea. It basically suggests that the chemistry that changes our bodies is oxidative stress. This is the chemical modifications of proteins and DNA and lipids by reactive oxygen species. And of course, this is where the word antioxidant comes from. It's an agent which dampens down on oxidative stress. One of the biggest players in that theory is the mitochondria. This is a part of your cell involved in energy metabolism, and it tends to generate a lot of oxygen radicals under certain circumstances. So, you know, it's a theory which I'm completely at one with. I absolutely think in the end that's the chemistry that drives parts of protein aggregation. It's the chemistry that the body's fighting against with its homeostatic mechanisms a lot of the time. But I'll tell you, a lot of scientists have fallen out of favor with it, and there are mainly due to genetic studies where people have altered the natural antioxidants, the body's own enzymatic antioxidants, and nothing's happened to aging. So it's a paradox right now. I believe in the chemistry, and I think that we're going to find out why these experiments are not giving the expected results right now.
Oh, I just have one final question for the vitamin doctor. How much vitamin D3 do you take on a daily basis?
I take 5,000 IU 5 days a week, and my serum level is around 63 nanograms. I weigh about 140 pounds, and there's a sort of relationship between your weight, but there are other factors that play a role too. So you really have to have your vitamin D level test if you want to know where you are with dosing.
We have time for one more question. Unfortunately, our time's almost gone. But Dr. Lithgow, will you stay and answer individual questions? All right. One more for the record. All right.
What is the minimum level of vitamin D3? I mean, if you have a blood test, and you see what level you're at, what would you suggest as the suggested level to be?
You want to be at least above 30 nanograms, more likely above 40, maybe up to 50 nanograms per milliliter.
All right.
Open the can of worms there.
We want to give our thanks to Dr. Gordon Lithgow from the Buck Institute for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 110th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned.